Hi, I'm Chris Hecker, and this is my lecture, How to Animate a Character You've Never Seen Before, talking about some of the problems we've dealt with on Spore and how we solve them. But first, I want to take a minute to make an apology for some of the stuff I said yesterday. I don't know who's read the internet yesterday, but so I was in a rant panel yesterday. I said a bunch of things, and I was trying to be thought-provoking and entertaining and fun, and a lot of the stuff went too far over the top on the entertaining and fun side, to the point where it was no longer thought-provoking. It was just inflammatory. And in the process, I hurt a bunch of people that I really care about. And so I want to apologize for that, and I want to make clear that, like, when I'm on stage, I'm talking from me. This is me, Chris Hecker. I'm not representing EA or Maxis or the Spore dev team, all of which are composed of really smart people who are all opinionated and have their own opinions about things and disagree with me at plenty of occasions. And so I want to make two things totally clear. I do not think the Wii is a piece of shit. Nintendo needs to be applauded for trying to innovate on the controller front, on the user interface front, on making games accessible, on making a console that you don't have to mortgage your house to afford. All of those things need to be applauded. And secondly, it's totally obvious, and I'm sorry that I implied otherwise, that everyone at Nintendo is incredibly passionate about making great games. Some of Nintendo's games are the games that give me hope that we will be considered an art form on par with film, literature, and music in the 21st century. And it was to sweep all of that away for a laugh with the crowd was unkind, uncool, and unfair. And I'm really sorry about that. So, all right. Okay. Here we are, the traditional game development pipeline. You make your pipeline, you make your assets. Oh, I'd like to really thank the guy who's loaned me a laser pointer every year for the past 5 years because I never bring one. You make your pipeline, you create the assets for that pipeline, you bake the assets, you test all of your assets, oh, are the polygons in the right order and that sort of thing, and then you ship your game. on Spore, we did it a little bit different. We make the pipeline, and then there's the mystery box, and then we ship the game. And then we create all the assets, or our users create all the assets, and then they bake the assets, and they play the game with them. And so what goes in this mystery box? And that is the topic of today's talk for one of the kinds of assets. So what kind of assets can you make in Spore? You've probably seen a couple, you know, Will's GDC talk and stuff from E3 last year, and there are at least two talks this year. Haim is giving a talk on Friday, and so is Ocean Quigley, our art director. So you can make planets, you can make vehicles, you can make buildings, you can make creatures, and there's a couple other smaller things you can make, but these are the main four things you can make, and they're all pretty hefty game assets, the kind of thing that you would, you know, build in Maya or whatever in a traditional game pipeline. We're going to focus on the creatures this time around, and there are really four parts that make up a Spore creature, and those parts are the skin, laser pointer guy, yes, like the skin, obviously, and the paint on that skin, or the surface qualities, like this is obviously a normal mapped skin with some, you know, diffuse and specular and whatnot. And then, taking it a lower level than that, there's the parts. All of the fists and feet and the stuff that does not look like a metaball skin are all done in Maya as what we call rig blocks. Those are part of the talk today, although it's a minor part. And then there's the bones, which are the boxes that underlie that. You can see the bounding boxes of the parts in this image. And so, really quickly before I go on, I want to say that there's an amazing team of people who work on this animation system, including the animators and the testers and the producers. And this is not, I'm the person standing up on stage, but all of these people totally rock. So, this is not just all of my work. I want to make that clear. Okay. So, how does the animation system see the creatures? Well, there's obviously the skin, which is like, you know, traditional weighted mesh skin. And, that's loadable in our animation tool. Our animation tool is called Spasm. That's loadable. Yes. It's loadable in this tool, but it's mostly for WYSIWYG. Like, you can't modify the skin or anything like that. It's a purely export-only thing. Then there's the bodies. Can be thought of as the bones of the system. So in the case of here, you can see the bounding boxes of all these guys, and if I pull away the skin, you can see what the creature actually looks like to the animation system. It's a bunch of linked rigid bodies. And these parts, the parts part of this, have capabilities associated with them. So the hands have the fact, they're tagged, excuse me, with the fact that they're hands. The mouth has how good of a mouth it is, whether it can attack, whether it's carnivore, herbivore, or omnivore, that sort of thing. There's all this kind of metadata associated. Feet have, like, whether they can jump and yada, yada, yada. And if you look at it, you can see there's really three types of bodies on these guys. There's the part bodies, like the mouth and the hands and whatnot. Then there's limbs, which are these skinnier ones, which are bones, which you can drag out in the editor and stuff like that. And then there's the spine, which is a special case thing because we found for manipulation purposes, as you'll see in Heim's talk. The spine is a special case. They're all bodies as far as the animation system is concerned, but they're all marked up slightly differently. And then between all those, we run IK chains. There's the joints that talk about how they're connected. And we run IK chains, which I'll talk about in more detail later. Okay, so from an editor standpoint, we try to put as few limits on the topology and morphology of these creatures as possible. One of the biggest limitations we put on, or constraint on the user, is the tree structure. We used to not have this. In playtest, it turned out that being able to make creatures that could loop and were arbitrary grass was incredibly difficult. But by going to a tree structure with the spine body as the core, we gained a lot of usability. And I'm sure Heim is going to talk a ton about that. So one more constraint that we use, what that means is there are no loops, which we can use to our advantage. Not only the user interface advantage, but also from a code standpoint. There are some socket constraints, like feet only can attach to the end of limbs, which have sockets on them. Other things can attach just wherever. There are some scale limits. You can't just size it arbitrarily the size of a planet and that sort of thing, which is obvious. And then there's some shader bone limits, right? Like, there's, you know, eventually this stuff has to dump out to the hardware. I almost said the S word. I'm going to just not go there. Eventually all this stuff has to dump out to the hardware, and there are obviously limitations on that. So here's some examples. I was kind of paging through these, or the slideshow was kind of going through these at the beginning. And you can see there's a pretty wide range of crazy, wacky guys that you can get going, all the way from, like, you know, relatively traditional bipedy kind of guy to whatever that thing is. And like, you've got this, which is like, oh, somebody just inflated the spine and stuck a bunch of crap on it. It's like, ah. And then this guy, I don't know if you can see, but, like, so this way is forward. This guy's face is on the side of him, and, like, the player, the tester who made this doesn't know that we don't have, like, we don't try and figure out which way is forward. We like, have the UI trying to assert that. So this person, on purpose, built a creature that's sideways. And we have to just make something work with this. Now, our animation art director, Bob King, thinks that we should, when create a player, we should have some code that detects creatures like this. And then when the player makes one, we have four burly creatures come in and beat the shit out of it. to kind of provide a negative feedback loop on it. But, you know, we really want to, like, try and, like, enable the user to be as creative as possible. So given all this, we have a really kind of large problem. And that problem is, how do we make this all work? How do we make them move? How do we show intent and purpose? I mean, so being able to just jiggle around is not one thing, but how do we show intent and purpose, which is what animation is? And as a bonus, like, how do we convey emotions from the creature? And so I'm going to... This is a pretty demo-heavy thing, so I'm going to... And I should have started this up beforehand. So here's a... here's our tool Spasm, which is a custom OpenGL crazy tool. Here's like a line of creatures you can load up in here. And I was going to really briefly play an animation of these guys doing a flip to show that, like, you know, you can get a kind of like, oh, these happy guys are doing a flip, and, like, it works on all of these guys. This is kind of a preview of what we're going to be talking about here. So how do we make this work? So our first idea here was, let's describe the movement. How do these guys move? The first way we decided to approach that is actually just the way you describe things to computers, which is code. So we tried for a classically procedural approach to this problem, where we had, like, this kind of Lua scripting language, and it would, you know, talk about parts on the creature and how they should move with curves and whatnot, timing information and things like that. And this, as you can see, is pretty complicated. If you saw the GDC demo that Will gave, two years ago, everything, and this works, like, everything in there, from him running around and chasing the prey to eating it to, like, having the tribe members pick up the spears with their tails and stuff like that, was all done in this system. So you can get it to work, but it actually, it forces the answer of another question is who do we hire now? Cross-disciplinary people are incredibly valuable, but you can't make a plan for staffing up to 100 people counting on being able to find cross-disciplinary people. They're great when you find them, but they're very difficult to plan for. So do we want animators who can program, or programmers who can animate? And the reality is, you need to take a step back, because we want to hire animators who can animate. This is a screenshot from Lady and the Tramp, and this is Frank Thomas from Disney Nine Old Men animated. This is the best animated scene ever recorded in the history of film, just so you know. But so how do you do this thing where you can have animators do what their central skill is, the thing that they get the big bucks for, on a creature they haven't actually seen before? So we started to try and figure this out. And we realized the solution was to allow them to show, not tell. Because telling means breaking things down into this level, and a lot of this stuff is intuitive. So there's this in SIGGRAPH and the game industry, there's this concept of example-based methods that are kind of like gotten cool since the late 90s and are now kind of like a big deal. And this is kind of the direction we went. It's not descriptive, because the descriptive turns out to be too hard to get the subtlety. But by being example-based, they can just show us what they're doing, and then we somehow have the software figure out how to apply that from the example creature onto other creatures. So here's a screenshot from this Maya mock-up we did a long time ago, showing what we wanted this to look like. There's a guy in the foreground, and the animator is doing the normal Maya-style animations on him, and the guys in the background are just somehow, and this is just totally mocked-up screenshot, doing what he says in the background. This is important to be able to see these multiple creatures, because now you can see how well the generalization of this magical process is working, right? It's like, oh, I drag this over, and I can subtly adjust it on the foreground creature so that in the background creatures, it looks better, right? Okay, so how do we get from this mock-up screenshot to something we can actually use? So the first step is to watch what they actually do. And it turns out, so watch the animators do traditional Maya animations in some of our back in our prototype pre-production days, and it turns out that they do two things, basically. They select things, and then they move them around. this is a deep, incredible insight. they also key the things that they move around. But it's interesting, because both of these fundamental building blocks of how you make an animation are really hard when you don't actually know anything about the creature. So let's go through them one at a time. Selecting. So here's two screenshots I ripped off of High-End 3D of like an ogre guy and like a dragon, right? In Maya, if I click down on this guy's left thumb, it's like Bone 57 has been selected. Now, what are the position, rotation, key, ability parameters of Bone 57? But what's Bone 57 on the dragon dude? Like, it's not going to be his thumb. It might be like the bone in the middle of his like tail or something. It has no meaning, right? And so sometimes people try and get around this in games by like, okay, we'll have a naming convention. So like left thumb, whatever, it'll be the right, you know. But then oftentimes it's like ogre underscore left thumb, and then that's not what's on the dragon, and then they don't, you know. So like the concept of like having absolute bone naming, whether it's a number or a text-based name, kind of falls short when you're trying to like make this generalize across lots of creatures. So what did we do? We realized that we need to add semantics to this. This is a place where description is important. Excuse me. When the animator goes in and says, okay, I'm going to select this hand and then I'm going to move it over here, we need them to help us out. We need them to tell us what they're doing. What is their intent with this animation? What are they trying to make happen so that we can then take that intent and put the intent on the other creatures? So we need them to describe what they're selecting. So, for example, down here, I would like to select the left topmost grasper, please. Okay? We call this a context. There's a context, and that's what does selection in our system. It's kind of like when you're using iTunes or your email program filters and stuff, and you're saying like, okay, I've got like 8 billion albums in there, so I really want, you know, They Might Be Giants from the year 2000, this specific song name, or this, not this specific song name, so you can get all the albums because you really hate that one song or whatever. So let's go through a demo of that. Oh, these guys are still jumping. Okay. Let me get some UI back here. Okay, so here's this guy. He actually has a front and a back, so he's a mean guy as well. He has a context. This area, so we're looking right here. You see where the mouse is? Everyone can see this, okay? This little drop-down here is basically the same as that iTunes selector from the previous page. What's it saying? Well, here's just the name of the context, so it's just saying, like, hey, I can, you know, name it Grasper or whatever. I could name it High, whatever. But now, what type is it? And there's a bunch of different types, but the most important, the most common one is CAPS query. It's a capabilities query on this creature, right? So again, all of these bodies here have all of this type information associated with them here. Like, this is a Grasper, it's a weapon, it's a slasher, and it's gestural, okay? And so... this one is saying, hey, I'm a CAPS query, and I'm selecting graspers. If I set this to, say, feet, it selects all the feet, right? If I set it to say spine, is spine in here somewhere? There. Hey, look, all the spine bodies are selected. Going back to Grasper, there's more we can drill down. So this is kind of like selecting the album, right? And then I can select whether it's on the left side or the right side, right? And so now both of these are selected, but those other guys aren't, or just front and back. So maybe left side and... So here's front. So now it's these two guys. And like I can combine those, right? Because why not? It's like kind of this like, database query system. And now it's just this one guy. And so I've got this one guy selected, and now my movement's all happening on this guy, you know? But I can also say, like, okay, there's some disambiguation ones, because, like, for example, on front, on left, like, both of these guys are selected, but what if I want the leftmost guy, right? And so this guy is incrementally more left than that guy, and it's always guaranteed to return unique. But in general, it can return more than one, and that's an important thing we'll talk about in a minute. So if you look at this, and you say, hey, I can also... take the initial part of the selection and move up from that on the limbs. So I can move to, like, it tries to figure out where the shoulder might be, or I can go the one we use most often. It goes all the way to the spine segment. So now, remember, these two left side guys were selected, and now it goes to the spine segment for those guys, which is kind of like having some clavicle control, but it's like procedural. It's like trying to figure out where that might be on the guy. Okay? From a code standpoint, this is very similar. You fill out a data structure which basically says what you're selecting. It's got all that same information in it. It's leftmost grasper of power 3 or whatever. And then you run a context query on the creature. And it starts to get a little tricky because it can return 0, 1, or many bodies. Like if I on this guy back here, if I go back and I say, hey, let's remove the extent stuff. I want to select center. Well, this guy doesn't have any center. Center's a region down the middle of the guy. He has no center graspers. So which you want to support, because I need to be able to put in an animation a superset of what any one creature might have on it, right? So this context query can return 0, 1, or many bodies, and the code has to deal with that. This is how the code reasons about the creature, right? And this, by this I mean both gameplay code and animation system code. They do database queries basically like this on the creature. I mean, it's just a linear loop of the guys, and it just matches all of the things. It's not, using the term database is a little bit fancy, but it does these query system on the creature, and that returns the selection, and you have to deal in your code with the fact that you may have selected multiple things. So, for example, if you're doing, like, in tribe game, the guys can pick up spears or whatever. Like, if the guy has five, if you do a context query for left hand and it returns five things, do you pick up five spears? Do you just pick the first one? Do you narrow your context query? If he doesn't have any hands, what do? Do you query for the mouth? That kind of thing. This is really hard. This is one of the places where it pushes the complexity up into the gameplay code if you really want to be taking advantage of some of the magic of Spore, right? Like, the fact that the player made this creature is... you want the code to be responsive and reactive to the fact that they put five hands on the left-hand side and no hands on the right-hand side. They want to see, I mean, they do that partially because they want to see what we're going to do with that, right? It's exploring the space of the interactions. Okay. So, let's move on to moving. How do you punch something? So, traditionally, you'd say, okay, well, I've got bone 57 selected, right? And I'm going to move it to these coordinates. And if that happens to be the end effector of an IK chain on a hit on a fist, and I move it to a position where I know that I will line up the nose of the other guy or whatever, you know, James Bond will then punch the guy. But this, again, not only is the bone 57 part of this not going to work for Spore, it's not clear that the position part works for Spore either. So let's talk about why. We need to... because, like, the guy's fist might be way back here, or it might be over here, and you don't know where the thing, even if you handle the selection part like we've been talking about, how do you make the movement part relative and intentional in the way that we've been talking, that we did for the selection? So again, we require semantics. We require the animators to really describe what they're talking about, and not describe it in a procedural, like, programming language way, because we were realizing that wasn't going to scale, but describing it, how can we make it so they can describe it in a way that isn't onerous to describe? They can use their skill set to actually move it around graphically, WYSIWYG style, but still get the data we need to project that onto lots of other creatures. And the way we decided to do that, or figure out to do that, is that we make this description the frame of the animation, and then record the animation kind of traditionally in that frame, and then we can bend that frame onto other creatures. We're going to go into details about how that works. So it's really kind of Mad Libby, actually. So here are some modes we support, for example. Move the grasper, which could be an arbitrary context query, right, to the same creature, meaning my own grasper, to my mouth, right? That's me, like, scratching my mouth or whatever, or putting a piece of fruit in my mouth, right? I could move my grasper to another creature's grasper and do a kind of a handshaky kind of thing, or slap the person's hand or whatever. The specifics of the movement within that frame are up to the animation. This just says how it's working. So at runtime, we bind the two creatures together and say, oh, he's moving in the frame of this, and I'm going to go into a lot of specifics about that. Move the mouth to the external target. Oh, there's a piece of fruit on the ground. I want to eat it. I want to eat the piece of fruit. Move the slasher to the ground, which means, like, hey, I want to pound the ground with all my slashers, and I want to make sure they hit at the ground at the same time. And this brute, or maybe to an absolute position. These last two bring up this next problem, which is scaling. If I do a movement on a single creature, why, and I do a big movement, I go, wah, right? Why is that movement big? There's a bunch of reasons that movement could be big. It could be big because the creature is just big. Like, so the creature goes like this, and it's just doing, you know, a normal thing, and a tiny little creature should just go like this, right? It could be big because the movement is inherently big. Like, tiny creatures should really go like this, and the big creature's like, you know, whatever. It could be relative to the scale of the creature. It could be, I'm trying to do this, like, you know, movement relative to a target, and that target just happens to be far away. And so if that target was closer, I'd want to do that movement in close. All of these are reasons why you might get the exact same curves out of a single animation, but once you try and bring it into different scenarios, it needs to change, and it needs to have these semantics. The animator in our system has to tell the system which one it is. So let's look at an example. Okay. So here's an example of, like, a context query of grasper left front top, right? Now this is interesting. This guy here has got lots of hands. I think he's actually named lots of hands. He's got, even though we're this specific over here, we've got left, front, and top, all of these satisfy that query. So we still, even though we really narrowed it down to like a quart, an octant of this guy, he still had two hands in there. Okay? This guy only has one because it's the topmost hand relative to all the hands, not relative to the creature. If I set this to topmost, or to top relative to the creature, he wouldn't select because his hand is below his midpoint, right? So there's a bunch of different, like, even within here, you can drill down. So here, I move this and all of these hands move, right? And now I'm set right now just be relative to your rest position. So you see, these are the rest poses of each of these creatures. Now, I'm going to take a little segue here on rest pose. The rest pose, as anyone who does animation knows, is really important to the quality of the animation you get out. And in fact, the game industry is kind of like switching from the Da Vinci style rest pose to the, I've heard it called zombie, and I've heard it called Harley Rider rest pose, because it's a more natural, you know, in between bend of your, the extents of your movement. We don't have a rest pose that's been designed by an animator. All we have to work with is how the player built the creature in the creature editor. And that's what the player is asserting, is like, this is the way my dude looks when he's standing still. And so we have that, and we treat that as the rest pose. And it's important because we make a bunch of stuff rest pose relative. So, for example, this motion is all rest pose relative. You see, here's the exact rest pose of these guys. And if I move to the ground, like, this guy at the end touches the ground first when I'm way not even close to the ground, right? So this is also scaling. So if we do scale mode none, now these guys are all moving the same amount absolutely. It's not scaling. If I scale versus the creature size, this big guy obviously moves bigger. If I can scale versus the current limb length, then you can see this middle guy's two hands move a different amount because those two limbs are attached to different length things. All of these are part of the way the animators describe what they're trying to do. And it's obviously got a little bit of a low-level aspect to it. Then within, and so I can do things like make this relative to the ground. Right now, especially if I scale with limb length, if I go to the ground, they don't all hit the ground at the same time. Like, dude at the end hit the ground first, right? If I make it ground relative, that says, no, all of these guys hit the ground at the same time. Now, this guy can't reach with one of his middle hands, but the guys who can reach hit the ground at the same time. So if I want all these creatures to be able to pound on the ground, this is one we added late. We didn't realize we needed this. But it's like, oh, wow, we want a bunch of pounding on the ground animations, and that means that if I'm going to sync that to sound, the pound has to happen at the same time in the animation, whether the guy's 20 feet tall or 3 feet tall. And so these are things we're learning as we're trying to, like, you know, generalize these animations across all these wacky creatures. Okay. Where's my PowerPoint? So When you're doing this movement and describing this movement, this creates, like I was saying, the frame that the animation is recorded in. And so in this example, and I'll look to a demo of this, this creature's trying to reach this external target. So let's, and the animation is recorded in that frame. So let's see. Okay. So here's an animation that I made, so don't expect much. And here are what the curves look like on these different creatures. So when I say frame, the frame of this animation, in this case, I'm relative to this external target, which is a thing that the gameplay can set. Like, this is where the fruit is, or this is where the nose of the other creature is, or that sort of thing. You can see that the animation curve changes based on where this is. It's like a parameter of input into this animation. And so if I'm having these guys move, they'll move over to where that thing is. And so you can see, you can kind of visually see, if you're used to working with coordinate systems, that this is doing, is really kind of just like bending this frame. It's like a rotation, a scale, and a skew around as you move this. And so what happens is, and to be concrete about this, we record the frame, for example, in an external target. For each of these modes and combinations of modes, we have to figure out what the correct frame is to record this thing in. And so in this case, the frame is recorded from the rest pose of the guy to the external target. And then there are modes based on, do I stretch the coordinate system so that he always tries to reach the external target, or do I just do it directionally in the direction of the external target? So, for example, a place where that's important is, like, if I'm going to punch somebody, I want to make sure that it looks like a punch all the time, right? But if the target is right in here, I don't want to do this. I want to follow through all the way, right? So really what I want to do is aim it in the right direction, but just have the direction is being what changed based on the external target, but the animation curve be preserved in the way the animator made it. By contrast, if I'm grabbing a piece of fruit off a tree, I don't want to, like, grab past the fruit. I want to do the dainty little movement if the fruit is near me and a bigger movement if it's far away. And as a secondary point, these frames get projected onto these guys per body, okay? So these two, on this Lots of Hands guy, has two graspers. That curve is the same curve, but being projected out onto the body, on the two different bodies. Because they each have different rest pose, they get a different coordinate system in which the frame gets instanced on them. And so this is like the fundamental, so there's a selection query aspect, and here's the fundamental part of the moving aspect. There are these two coordinate systems that we work with. And by work with, I mean the code deals with. When you have a specific body at a specific location, that's called specialized. That means the animation has been instanced onto that body and scrubbed to the frame where it is and interpolated and yada, 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 and set with all the modes of for movement, and it resolves to a 3D position somewhere, hopefully near the creature. In animation side, when you can take that specialized position and take all of those modes and invert that transform to this generalized space. And so what we do, and that generalized space is where everything lives. An animation can't have markup specific to a creature in it, because that same animation plays on a million different creatures, on a million different people's machines. So those keys are stored in generalized space, which is inside the frame of that. So if there's a look at matrix from the rest pose to the external target, and there's some scaling vectors and, like, deciding that it's 0 to 1 to the ground so they can all hit the ground at the same time and whatnot, those numbers come back. That's in generalized space. And then that's specialized by projection onto each creature body. So even within the same creature, if I do a query and I get three hands back, I specialize three times from this one animation onto those guys. And so this is the core of the whole system. And so then the question is just, what are the modes you have for moving, for knowing how to do that transformation and the inverse transformation? And that's just like you add those as you see fit for trying to express things in the animation. When your semantics, and I'll talk about this more a little bit later, when your semantics can't describe, when the ones you provide, the grammar you provide, can't describe what the animator is trying to describe, you have to add more stuff or avoid that movement, right? Okay. So really simply, just to get concrete, here's our animation file format. Like, hey, it's an animation. Inside there are multiple channels. Inside the channels are a context, right? A context is the thing that says, what is this thing on? It's on graspers, it's on mouths, it's on, you know, whatever, tails, or, you know, feet. there's these descriptions for movement, like I was saying, the Mad Libs and the scaling bits that say, like, oh, I'm ground relative, and I'm relative to the external target, or I'm relative to the, here's a hard-coded context query for the other guy, like it's a nose of another guy, because I know it's always a nose-reaching animation or whatever. And then there's key data, which is just this raw floating-point data that you have to know this stuff to know how to decode, right? Because it's like, it's stored in this generalized space. It's just arbitrary, like these weird numbers that wouldn't mean anything if you don't have the description of how it got there, so you can invert the transform. There's also other stuff in here, like some of the, all the rig blocks, or a lot of the rig blocks have deform channels on them for things like hands opening and closing. Like, we don't have bones for each individual finger exposed at the animation, at the procedural animation level. That's all done the traditional Maya way. Like, each of those blocks you can pop onto guys has a little bone structure inside of it if we deem it important enough and it can make the budget and whatnot. Mouths opening and closing and, like, you know, licking their lips and smiling and frowning, eyes blinking, you know, ears wagging, that kind of thing. This all happens inside what we call deforms, these channels in the rig blocks. Those are controlled to the same thing. And those are exposed in a data-driven way. If I do a context query on a mouth, I get. If I do a context query on a mouth, or this is a grasper, I get closed open and point exposed to me because I know that this is a grasper, right? And if I switch this context query to a mouth, I'll get a different set in the graph editor. Where is this movement? I'll get a, this is a graph editor, but I can't see anything to show up in there, so I'm going to ignore it. But I'll get a different set of deform channels exposed to me. And those deform channels can't be, they have to be, they're not hard-coded to a specific part. Like, we can't say this grasper, you've seen the demos of the creature editor where, like, there might be 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 graspers, right? Or 20 or 50. All those graspers have to have a common language for communicating how open-close works and how point works. Because all you know at the level of spasm is that it is a grasper that you will select, and so here's the 0 to 1 or, you know, whatever deform channel values, and it shoves them in there as it goes. But it has to be totally blind. It has to be totally standardized. Okay, so here's our runtime loop. For each creature, for each animation on each creature, because, hey, we can blend and, you know, do that sort of thing. We tick the animation channels to the time. Now, remember, inside the animation, everything's stored in generalized space. So this ticks all the animation channels, and everything is splined in animation space too, or in generalized space. So now we've got a bunch of generalized coordinates that don't mean anything until we do the context query on the creature. Right, and so for each channel, we context query the creature, and then for each body, which might not loop. Like, if nothing got selected this time, there won't be anything here, and we are not playing this channel on this creature. We specialize it onto the body, and then we specialize it on the body. So, like, this is then that body now has goals blended into it for this animation. There's only one animation; the goals will be sitting there. Then we do this thing called we do gates, which are how you walk, which I'll talk about in a minute, and wiggles, which I'll also talk about in a minute, our wiggle system. It's crazy. The most advanced wiggle system in the entire game industry. And then we dump all of this into an IK solver, which we'll also talk about in a minute. Okay, so let's talk about gates first. From a gameplay standpoint, the gameplay code, we didn't want to expose whether it had 3 legs or 5 legs or 2 legs of 2 short legs and 15 long legs up to the gameplay code, right? You just go insane. Like, it's hard enough to just know how many, it's hard enough to write code that deals with a variable number of, like, hands where you can hold things, let alone, like, how many feet and all this kind of stuff. So what we do is we bake all of the gate information into stats at the time when the creature is loaded. So, like, if he's got, like, 5 level 6 feet, like, he runs at 3 meters per second or whatever. And that gets to be a thing that the gameplay can then go, like, okay, here's how fast creatures move. And then the gameplay code drives around just an oriented particle. Here's what direction it's facing, and I drive it around, and we assume that the gameplay code deals with the speed, you know, limiting, makes the speed the correct gameplay speed for their tuning. Okay, right? So that's from the gameplay side. And the gate system just tries to keep up. Okay? It tries to, if the thing is turning, it tries to make the feet put in the right place for turning. It differences to the position to find velocity so that the gameplay code doesn't have to track desired velocity and things like that. It basically back figures out all the stuff necessary to make a smooth gate walk around, which is hard, but keeps the gameplay programmers from going insane. So how does the gate system work? The first thing it does is it clusters the legs based on length. So this guy might have a cluster of 4 for the outer legs, and there's this one weird stubby leg in the middle. So you might have 2 gate clusters, right? Because you want, if you've got some short legs and some long legs, you want a different gate cycle running on those so it looks cool. Not to mention the fact that they each have different stride lengths and stuff. And so speaking of that, The gate stuff has a bunch of tunable parameters settable by the animators and storable, like step height and step length. Trigger and duty factor, which are scientist called Mary discovered in, I think, the turn of the century, and I stole this from Baron Robb's lecture, who's a guy who works on the gates mostly. He gave a presentation in Hamburg, and I totally just directly ripped this drawing he made out of his slides. Thanks, Baron. The gate cycle, basically how much the trigger is when your cycle starts in the 0 to 1 time of the cycle, and how and the duty factor is how much of that is down. When does your down phase on the ground happen? So, for example, with run, you have a flight phase where neither foot is down on the ground. With walk, you have times when both feet are down on the ground, right? And there's a bunch of other stuff that you can set associated with the gates, like toe curl and ankle angle and like hip bob and rotation and how much how much it sways. And all of these things can be combined to do style. So, for example, by having different gates stored out that are used on different numbers of legs at different speeds, you can do guys who convert from walk to trot to gallop as part of the thing. And what those are is these velocity-based keys that then change the parameters of the gate system depending on what velocity they're at. Let's do a random mix of dudes. Let's see. Okay, so here's some random mix of guys with different numbers of legs. These all have the same parameters on them right now, and this is not a custom-built gate that an artist has done. I just have a little gate in there. So, so you can see, like, they walk at different. They're all walking the conceptually same velocity, but they all have a very different character about how they're walking. we can also show just the variety. Like, here's a bunch of guys with all different numbers of legs, like 1 through 6. Here's a bunch of guys only with 6 legs. So, like, here's a guy that's got 2. You know, he's probably running 2 different gates on the inside. Here's a totally crazy guy. This is the kind of stuff we have to deal with. He's got 2 long back legs and 2 front legs that then fork into 2 short legs. So he's probably running 2 different gate groups on the front 4 and the back 2, I would guess. And you can see that kind of a different thing. Here's like a bunch of really long, spidery, crazy legs with what look like hands at the bottom of them. And here's your generic little 6-legged dude. Okay, so let's talk about wiggles, shall we? We want secondary animation. By that, we usually mean like physics-y kinds of feeling things, like tail bobbing, arm swaying, that sort of thing. But we don't want to have to manually key it. This is really important because there's the state space of our creatures, like the breadth of our creatures, is massive. And so knowing what kinds of stuff might be on the creatures is incredibly hard, especially if you just want it to bob up and down when the guy's walking. So in a hand-done animation, you might, or a very specific case in Spore, you might want to select something and hand-key the secondary. That's obviously totally, I mean, it's just another animation channel. But in general, like if you're doing playing an animation on these guys that doesn't need to talk about pokers, like it's not playing an attack animation, it's just doing a like, let me do a backflip, or let me wave to somebody with my hands, except for this guy who doesn't have hands. He has some weird spike things on him. You want these things to just bob around kind of naturally. And so what do? We have a totally procedural system for this that John Deweese wrote that says basically, hey, what are the wiggleable bodies on this creature? So before any animations have been bound to this guy, what could wiggle? And it parses the creature and says, like, oh, there's like a long chain of stuff here, so this is clearly wiggleable, and like maybe, you know, like the end of his head is wiggleable. And then we say, hey, what didn't get selected this frame, right? Like, what of all the animations we've got bound to this guy, what got no goals on it that is also wiggleable? And we put damp spring mass systems on there. Okay? Hi, guys. So here's an example of just some random guys, and I've got just a single root context on them, so everything else is been selected by wiggles. And you can see what the wiggle system has decided to select on these guys. And you can see you get the secondary animation. That would just be a giant pain in the butt to hand animate, especially for, like, this guy's got, like, four mouths on the end of limbs. Like, you'd have to know that that was the case to actually animate those. Like, who would put wiggles on mouths? But this, like, automatically figures out what to do. And here's our, like, mini hands guy down here. Lots of hands. He's got the... Whee! All right. So that's the wiggle system. But if I select something, it doesn't get wiggles. It lets the animation override. And if I blend in and out, it tries to do the right thing. So we've got all this stuff, and we have to continue just to ask the following question. How well does an animation generalize across lots of creatures? We obviously can't test all the creatures, because there is no all the creatures for our game. So we need to do some kind of stochastic testing model. And so what we come up with is something called the animation validation grid. Steve and Patrick, our awesome animation testers, go through creatures by animations every week with a different taste of, like, this is like Civ animations, and like maybe it'll be, you know, Gates one week and a Tribe animations with Tools the next week or whatever. And we make this giant chart. And our testers have to be able to judge the aesthetics of an animation for whether it passes or fails. So in this case, we've got a lot of greens good and reds something we got to look into, right? So this guy, these first four or five animations fail on this guy. And so what are these reasons? Like, lower body with high root interpenetrates the ground. Okay, so that's something like, do we need to, at the point where we see a failure, we got to say, hey, what do? Is it just a bug in the code? That would be awesome, because we just fixed the bug, we're done. Is it something the animator could touch up? Like, oh, this is almost close, but I really just need to adjust this and make it generalize a little bit more by making it a little bit more generic of a movement. It was authored a little bit too specifically. Maybe we just need to put this guy in the conga line of guys that animator is using when he's making this animation. Or is it something where it's like, I just didn't have the semantic richness, the grammar to describe what I was trying to do. In that case, hey, we have to add a feature to the system. Like, I'm trying to hit the ground all the same time on these guys, but all of their hands are at different rest pose height. There's no way to express they all hit the ground at the same time. It doesn't matter what scaling modes you use or whatever. We had to add ground relative. Or is this something that, like, there's no easy way to make a generalizable thing? And if that's the case, we can turn to branching. If you imagine the creatures as this incredibly high-dimensional state space, you can think of planes through the state space of, like, guys who have graspers and guys who don't obviously are on one side or the other of a plane of has graspers. Whether I have feet or not, like, we have slug-based gates and slug creatures, and slug creatures could have, you know, they don't have to have feet. You could have a full, like, articulated upper body with hands and, like, whatever and just not have any feet. So it's not like you are only a slug or not. It's just whether you have feet or not. Those are obvious planes through the state space, but there's also, like, kind of more subtle ones, like, what direction is my spine pointing? Is my spine mostly upright or mostly prone? Because I'll do a totally different lunge animation based on whether I'm pointing upwards like a biped like me or whether I'm like a dog and prone on the ground. And we can split up state space with this and tag the animations, to play on guys that fall on either side or some binary operation combination of these planes. And this is kind of problematic. This is obviously incredibly powerful. Now I can make a custom animation on these two different kinds of creatures. But boom, we just solved that by throwing content at the problem. So we have to be really careful, because you could easily, like, just blow out the number of animations trying to, like, capture the subtleties of every possible guy with, like, 8 million planes. The tyranny of the curse of dimensionality really starts to catch up with you here. So we need to be really careful, and we're just starting to experiment with this part of it now. How much branching? We've got different theories about how much branching we're actually going to have to do, and what the set, like, how complicated these branching queries are going to have to be. So we don't know yet. But this is obviously, like, we can throw this is a system that allows us to throw content at the problem, as opposed to if we can't figure out how to increase the power of the grammar in a certain case. Okay, so we skipped the IK solver part, and so we're going to talk about that really briefly. So at the end of all of that stuff, all of the stuff blends onto all these bodies and stuff, and now all these bodies have goals, but the actual bodies aren't independent. They're all connected by this joint system, right? I mean, the player stuck them together with arms and limbs and whatnot. So what do? We decided to just dump everything into a giant full-body IK solver. And the reason we did this is because we need to decouple these various high-level procedural systems from having to think about how the creature is shaped. Like, we can't have wiggles have to think about whether it's a 5-link or a 6-link arm in its code. And we can't have, you know, ground relative having to go, like, well, I don't know if I can reach it here because I only have a knee and a... Like, the code would just explode. So what we do is we just assume all of these goals are reachable, and we let the IK solver sort it out. So we have a bunch of constraints on the IK, our requirements or desires, constraints, requirements, and desires on the IK solver. I mean, first we need to be fast, right? This is how our procedural animation, this is the end point of our procedural animation system, and all the high LOD creatures in the world are running on this, right? It needs to be accurate inside the workspace. What does that mean? So in robotics, there's this concept of end effector, which is like a fancy word for hand or whatever, the end of a robot arm. And the workspace of that end effector, which is like, if you imagine I'm like, my arm is attached to the wall, the workspace of my hand, because I've got a nicely jointed arm, is basically a hemisphere of a radius of the length of my arm, right? But if there was a blocker in the workspace, I'd have the holes in the workspace and whatnot. Or if I had like joint limits, I might not be able to reach over this side. So the workspace is where you can reach with that end effector. So what this requirement says is, if the body goal target is within the workspace of that body because the limb is long enough and whatever, we really would like to hit it because that's what the animator intended, right? And that sounds kind of obvious, but the problem is, if it's not, we want to fail gracefully, right? If it's outside the workspace, I want to stretch towards it, but stop, not just stretch the arm 40 miles across the planet or whatever. I don't want it to pop or do anything like that. I need to fail gracefully as the thing moves out of the workspace. And to make matters worse, there are some goals inside the workspace you don't want to hit. So imagine, for example, just thinking of me as a completely generic set of linked bodies, which I'm sure is how you guys think of me. If I had a target for my head and I smooshed it down here into my torso, you don't want to satisfy that. Even though like the linked body system like could totally satisfy that. There's plenty of degrees of freedom to me to shove my head down into my body. With help from some friends at Nintendo, I'm sure, at this point. You really want it to kind of compress a little bit, but then start ignoring that goal, right? You want to not, like, have it just buckle the spine up and shove the thing totally inside the body, because that just looks broken. It doesn't look natural. So that's a kind of hard one. That kind of takes reasoning. And there's a really, really a one that kind of came at us from nowhere that is obvious in hindsight, but that I can give you some insight into, is you want it to be path independent. What does that mean? So if you're writing a CCD-based IK solver, like in most games, for like, you know, putting feet on the ground or something like that, you usually initialize it with the results from a previous frame, right? Because it's nearby and it only has to take a few iterations to... It only needs a few iterations to converge then, because it's starting with like a, you know, basically, CCD is a very simple algorithm, and if you want to make it sound really fancy when you're doing it, it's a nonlinear solver with, a multidimensional nonlinear solver. And the closer you can start to a solution in those kinds of algorithms, the faster it converges, right? So, but that is not path independent. That means that If I have a surplus of degrees of freedom, like say a rope, I can tie it in knots by moving one way. And because every movement of my, because there are multiple solutions for any one position, like with my arm, how I got to where I am depends on the history, right? Which means a lot of things. It means the creatures can tie themselves in knots, right? As opposed to like, if it's always like this, whenever my hand is here, my elbow is always there, it's predictable. Even if I came around like this, it like adjusts itself back to be the path independent. If it's path dependent, I might end up like this. My hand is still at the goal, but the way I came towards it depends on what I was doing in the past. And when you're running this on guys, the IK solver, there's no feedback to like fix the IK solver, you know, from a human in the loop like there is in Max or Maya, where I'm doing a hand animation. It's like, oh right, I need to like, you know, restart it here or whatever. And you can see they have parameters for this in their solvers. This thing is going to run for hours. Creatures would be tied in knots if it was path dependent. So we have to make it path independent, and that's actually hard. We initialize from the rest pose and do some deformations to the rest pose so that it all every frame, which means our IK is slower than it would be if we were starting initialized from the previous frame's data, but the path independence constraint is so important to being able to have a predictable set of animations, especially once you start blending and all of this stuff. I need to like have the blend target go to zero. If I've got two animations A and B mixing together and I bring A, B up and then bring B back down, the animators want A to play after B goes back to zero in the exact same position that it was when they authored the animation, right, for predictability. So it's really important. Okay, I'll show a demo of the IK solver in a second. Let's do a little bit of history here. We started out, the very first one we did, this was in the GDC demo, was a bunch of linked rigid bodies with constraints on them and controllers and whatever in a normal physics system. And the problem is, physics systems are not built for a number of linked rigid bodies that we were trying to throw at it. And they're not built for them. You want to tumble and have piles of stuff and things like that. That's what physics systems are optimized for. So it was slow, inaccurate, unstable. And most importantly, it was not posable. Even in things in the workspace, it couldn't hit. Because there's a trade-off between making it stable and, or trying to make it stable and trying to have the joint limit on the controller set so that it can actually reach things. So this ran its course, and we eventually did something that we called the IK. That when we switched over this posability system, we initially called it, but it turned out to be IK 1.0 because there was actually future versions, which I'll talk about. And so what we did is we said, okay, we need to actually solve this not as a physics problem, but as a nonlinear solve problem. We made a CCD-based solver that was multi-branch, meaning like it solved the entire creature at one time, and it was full 6-degree of freedom because you want to be able to set orientation targets on end effectors as well as position targets. And it was this giant, insane piece of math. It was still slow. It was incredibly complicated. It was more accurate. It hit the goals a lot better. But because it was this giant black box of a monolithic math solver, it was very not tunable. It was very much like you could kind of like, I can turn it off on that body or maybe make it not iterate as many times, but I can't really like say, oh, just twist a little bit more here or there. There was no, it was just a total black box. So after the honeymoon, so this was a great improvement over this, but after the honeymoon period worked out, ran out, we're kind of like, we really want more. And so we started working on what we called IK2. And I started reading, doing some research online about this, and came across a paper that was kind of an IK paper from 1995 that had a really interesting like thing just stuck in the middle of the paper, which is that it said, the molecular dynamics people who have been doing 3-degree of freedom, chain rigid body, you know, linked things, long ago, after very few attempts, gave up on rotation at joints as a representation system. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And what that means is, like CCD, the way we normally do it with sines and cosines and all of this stuff, like, the molecular dynamics people who've been doing this since 1960, like, just said this is a dumb way to do it. And what they do is they do constrained particles. So if you have a 3-degree of freedom, a bunch of 3-degree of freedom joints, that's really hard to represent. What is the representation? Is it quaternions at the end? Is it Euler angles? It's just a pain. Whereas having a particle there and a particle here and then having just a length constraint between them gives you that 3-degree of freedom, and it's, like, 10 times faster. And it turned out to be 10 times faster for us as well. IK2 was incredibly fast, very accurate, way more tunable because the code is just way simpler to do a particle IK. This is kind of similar to the Jacobson rigid body stuff from GDC a few years ago. His stuff actually talks about in the paper how a lot of his stuff is very similar to a bunch of the molecular dynamics algorithms like Shake and Rattle. The problem is, the way I was doing it was very twitchy and failed poorly. And so because of the breadth of creatures and because we need to do animations that we're not, you know, like they're going to be, you're not going to be able to test all the animations on all of the creatures, it needs to fail well and fail humorously, not fail poorly. And what this did was it started twitching and freaking out, which is not acceptable, right? And I realized that I was kind of being control freak when I was doing this one. I was doing a full, like, if I had like if I had like a thing like a shoulders, which had like two arms coming into it and a torso and a neck coming into it, I was trying to constrain the that torso body by making it like a tetrahedron or a triangle is, you know, the degrees of freedom. Like you subtract out you got all these particles and you got all these constraints between them, and you subtract out, do all the right math, and you get a rigid body out of it. You can construct a rigid body, which is kind of what Jacobson's thing was about. But what happened was, by trying to lock that body down so much and being a control freak about it, when it failed, it would pop that body around and do all these kinds of things. You can see it if you write one of these and pull it around a lot. And so we went on to IK2.5, which is a much more laid-back approach. Instead of trying to have inside the IK solver constrain all of the bodies so I know they're going to act exactly right, I removed tons of degrees of freedom, or tons of constraints on degrees of freedom, and so now everything, like all of these limbs and necks and stuff, will just converge at a point, and it just pulls the spine around. And then I can reconstruct the orientation of things on the fly in a smooth way, and it fails much better. And so I'll give you a really quick example of this. Let's do this. Let's see. Okay. Do, do, do.
Let me just get this down to a single guy so we can see it easily. Okay.
So here's an example of, I just did the spine segment of this guy here. So now I've got control over this one body. The other thing that the laid-back particle IK 2.5 approach did is because the code is so much simpler, it's just like a bunch of particles, a bunch of constraints on those particles, or fewer than previously, and then a pass to construct those constraints, simulate the constraints, and then reconstruct the body orientations from that, you can put special cases in a lot of different places. So, for example, one I want to show you is... you can see the spine segment here. This used to be simulated as a bunch of linked rigid bodies. And the problem is, spines don't act like a bunch of linked rigid bodies. You don't want to animate it as a bunch of linked rigid bodies. Then I was having to add like tons of code to make it act like a spine and everything. What I did was I just like took the, again, like I just stepped back. This spine is now simulated. It looks for lengths that can be simulated as a spline. And it has a single link between those to keep it from being able to be stretched to infinity, but it now reconstructs based on this spline here. So if I rotate, you get this really pleasant curvature because it's running a Hermite spline between these two things. And I realized that you don't, like if this had been linked rigid bodies and you compress down in, they would buckle all over. But now that I've got this, now that I can reason about this spine as a special case thing, and there's a single place in the code where that's responsible for the spine's movement, I can compress the spine as it goes down. And so this is unrealistic, right? I mean, this is not acting like a set of rigid bodies. But the animators love this. This allows them for a few frames to like compress the guy down. And like, you know, as long as the skin weighting is okay, like, you know, it looks great. It's like you've got some squash and stretch, the whole like, you know, Disney animation thing going on here. And so, and it also like, because it's a much simpler code, like, I don't know if you can see this, but like, it compresses non-linearly. Like the ones in here compress down faster, which means like if there are parts on the end, it pulls the skin away from the parts so you can keep the face going even as it does compress the spine down, things like that. It just the new system lets us do that. So it's a much more like a kind of predictable linear situation. Okay. So we're getting really close to the end of my talk. So all this stuff works great for Spore, but Spore is a really pretty unique game. So what can you take away from this for a more traditional game? Even though I think more proceduralism was going to happen in a lot of different areas, we're kind of taking it to 11. So what can you take away here that for your own games? So I think there are four things, really. This concept of curves being recorded in a space that's relative to the things they're trying to do, I think is valuable. Animations that we have right now for things like, you know, reaching for things or pulling a gun or aiming or whatever, those have more information in their keyframes than we're taking advantage of in games right now. By having the animator specify some semantics, and that's what this overriding concept is, you can retarget that animation. You can warp that curve in a way that preserves all the work they did, all the tangential movement and the little subtle pauses before it goes for the jab and all that kind of thing. But you can have it stab over there or over there or over there. And people are starting to do this and been doing this for aiming by using example-based, like lots of IK, examples and then blending between them for the aiming kind of thing. And this kind of takes it to the actual nonlinear space. As opposed to just a linear blend between the different poses, now, hey, I'm actually warping the curves so they actually point in the right direction and that sort of thing. And this is a subset of this, which is semantics are valuable. Getting your animators to put semantics on your animations so you can reason about them in code bears a lot of fruit. It's the fundamental thing about our entire system. In SIGGRAPH right now, there's a big hot topic is animation retargeting, where they take a bunch of data from one skeleton and try and get it onto another skeleton. You do all this crazy nonlinear arithmetic or math to try and do that. And a lot of those problems become so much simpler when you actually know a foot is a foot and that this thing was trying to land on its hip, right? You're trying to back solve all that out of the original skeleton and everything and just have the animator tell you. Like, putting the human in the loop and just snipping that problem right there is incredibly valuable. Didn't really talk about this much, but like we originally pitched, and you saw that screenshot, we originally pitched this as a Maya plugin. I was like, okay, we'll do this with a Maya plugin because there's all this UI and stuff that Maya provides, and we'll just try and do this. And we ended up writing our own custom tool, and it was totally worth it. The thing that is the difference is it's A, not that hard to get the first order UI running, like position, you know, Q, W, and E all do position, you know, rotation and selection. I've got a time slider across the bottom, a graph editor, Maya camera controls and things like that. That stuff is not the hard work. It's not the research problem. It's not the thing you're going to be pounding your head against late at night. It's just like somebody's got to type it in, and it's not difficult. You want to make sure that you are focusing your energy on the hard problems. And the hard problem here was, how do I get this runtime system to do all this stuff? I need to display multiple creatures at the same time, be able to select any one of them and have it map back and forth. And you look at the way the commercial tools are not set up to allow that, from plugins, for example, or even inside. It's just a mess because they're all assuming you're working on a single thing. And so the decision of when to make a custom tool, like if the core thing that you're trying to do is very different, then I would encourage writing a custom tool. We're always like talking about this build-buy question, and a lot of the buy arguments come down on the side of, wow, it's really hard to emulate all of this UI and stuff. It's not actually that hard relative to the hard research problem you're trying to solve. That's the key thing you want to take away. And finally, the IK solver experience of really, like, just, you know, mellow, chill out on your IK. You got to take a step back and really get laid back. Is it much more successful? And put some of the smarts in the reconstruction. That's a really valuable thing. And so I'll leave you with a quick demo. Let me turn all this debug crap off. Let's see. Spasm doesn't actually currently support syncing to an external MP3 file, so I'm going to...
This is work by John Cimino, Kent Jolly, our fan guy. It just shows that you can get some pretty cool kind of emotional content going across a pretty wide range of feeds. All right, thank you very much.